This is Gorgeous Lives, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous. Hello, and today I'm very excited to be in the headquarters of my guilty pleasure, QVC Shopping Channel. For years now, I've been buying Today's Special Value and many beauty and jewellery bargains. I'm here with one of the first two presenters ever on QVC, Julia Roberts, who has the busiest life being a presenter, but she's also found time to write a book, the first in a trilogy called Life's a Beach and Then... Hi, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
Doesn't everybody think they have a novel in them? You obviously did. And why in the end have you knuckled down to write it?
I think you're absolutely right. Everybody thinks that they have at least one book in them. And I've always wanted to write one. But as you say, I've been here at QVC for almost 22 years. I've got two children. I thought being a mum was really, really important. So that took priority, really. I didn't have very much time with other presenting work to actually sit down and write a book. Then I wrote a memoir about 3 years ago called 100 Lengths of the Pool, which we sold here at QVC, and that was gratifyingly very well received. And it was just after that had gone live on air that I really felt that I needed a holiday because I'd also been diagnosed with chronic myeloid leukemia about 11 months previously. So we decided that we would go somewhere really beautiful and that I was going to completely relax. So the first morning in Mauritius, which is where we'd gone to, I suddenly sat bolt upright and said, I had a brilliant idea for a novel. And the next 10 days, unfortunately for my other half, was all about me talking about the plot for the book, the characters. They just seemed to spring into my head. And I suppose with the recent diagnosis of CML, one of my characters actually has the same disease.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about that later, but... tell us a bit about the books. What genre are they?
Well, women's contemporary fiction is the sort of general genre. It isn't a chick lit. It's got quite a deep story to it. It's quite sad. It's about relationships, really. The main character hasn't really had any kind of relationship with a significant other for almost 20 years. She's a single mum. And was abandoned and then shortly... abandoned by her boyfriend, I should say, and then shortly afterwards found out that she was pregnant. And when she divulged that to her mum then disowned her and said that she was never to see her dad again. So she's had quite a traumatic time of it, and she's found herself in an enviable position where she has a fabulous job, don't want to say too much about it, and she meets a British couple when she's in Mauritius on her job, and really likes the woman who she sees as a replacement figure for her own mother. And the woman really warms to her too and introduces her to a writer called Philippe. And she falls for him.
So we can't say any more.
Not too much more.
No, I agree. You've given a really good background to it. So had she got... so? What, her child was about kind of 18, 20 then?
Absolutely, yeah. So he, in fact, he was kind of responsible for getting her the job. I can't sort of elaborate too much, but they'd gone on holiday together. Obviously, finances had been really tight because she was a single mum and she'd done some work from home, but she'd never gone out to work because she wanted to bring up her son herself.
Very admirable. So,
finances were very, very tight. And then he'd been saving up, unbeknownst to her, from a bar job that he'd got in his first year at university. And he'd his paper ran from when he was 12.
Oh,
and he took her on a holiday. And then the idea sparked for the job that he then managed to get her.
Wow. Now, I know you've been ill and that kind of got you going with this writing. Obviously, it focused you a lot. But you've always had a fight in your life because you were you're young enough, or you're old enough, sorry, to unfortunately have had polio.
Don't say that, Josephine.
No, but unfortunately to, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it depends. It was when the MMR, I suppose, came in, you know.
Basically, I think I'm one of the youngest now to have got polio, not as a result of a vaccine, because unfortunately some people did.
God,
yeah. Well, I'm an ambassador for British Polio, and I've become more involved with them over the last 3 years, and I found out so much that I didn't know, because I spent most of my life almost denying that I'd ever had it.
Because I think you had to run away from it to fight the fight, I suppose, of life, didn't you?
Absolutely. I'm glad you understand that. Yeah. It wasn't just me digging my head in the sand, and no, it really was a case of, okay, well, I've, you know, had that challenge and I've dealt with it, and now I've faced it head on. I feel a lot better in some respects, because there is a strong possibility that it will come back and revisit me.
Radio Gorgeous, giving you a voice. Over to you now.
There's something called PPS, which is post-polio syndrome, and almost 100% of people who had polio as a child will get it in some form in later life. So it's another thing that I know I'm going to have to face, but I suppose knowing I'm going to have to face it actually kind of prepares you for it.
Now, I'm really interested to know, what is polio? Because we all, you know, I think of sort of, when I was young, you know, people in calipers, think of people, Ian Dury had it, you know, quite a lot of famous people, but what is it?
It's to do with the fluid in the spinal cord, basically, and it causes paralysis of the muscles. I was fortunate in some respects, it depends how you view it, but I was fortunate that it affected me on my left-hand side. So I was paralysed on the left-hand side up to just underneath my rib cage. Fortunately, it stopped before it got any further. So I have a severe weakness on that side, and the muscles waste away, basically. So when I came out of hospital, I'd been...
How old were you?
I was 14 months when I got polio.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I had just started to sort of be pulling myself up and starting to walk.
You can't... Is it a virus? You can't catch it, can you?
It is transmittable but through water. But, of course, we've had the vaccine here for a very long time.
Yeah.
Although it is still... you can still get it in places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nigeria. They've virtually eradicated it in India. They're very proud of that because of the vaccine. And in fact, I also got involved with Rotary, who were pushing for, the final push to eradicate it worldwide. So
fantastic.
some of the profits from my first book went to the End Polio Now campaign, and also British Polio Fellowship.
So you were a little girl. Did you have to spend a lot of time in hospital?
I was in hospital after the diagnosis, which originally my GP had told my mother. She'd taken me because I was fractious and irritable. And it was when there was a lot of scare about polio. You know, they were closing swimming baths because it was transmittable through water. So basically, she took me to the doctor, and he said, well, she's just teething. I was 14 months old. She's just teething. If you think she's got polio, she hasn't. And that was how he spoke to my mum. And 2 days later, she took me back and said, I want you to test her because I think she may have it. He called in a colleague who actually was an expert in the field. And instantly, I was rushed to hospital and put into isolation. And I was there for 5 months. I came out Christmas Eve, actually, in 1957.
Now, do you remember any of it? Because you're so young.
I don't. I mean, that's the great thing. I feel for my mum every time we ever talk about it, because, of course, it's all so real and raw for my mum. But I don't remember anything. The earliest memories I have, I was probably about 3 years old, and it's when they used to take me to the City Hospital in Nottingham for physiotherapy sessions. And those I do remember. And I remember sitting at home with my mum when I was a very little girl, and she would do lots of physiotherapy exercises with me. And then she started me at ballet classes when I was just before I turned four.
And was that to strengthen you? That was the idea. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But she didn't know you'd go on to have a career in it.
No. No, she didn't. And she also, I mean, bear in mind, I had a brother and a sister. So, you know, she... pretty hands-on with looking after the children. She took me to swimming, which was organised by the British Polio Fellowship. So I have kind of come full circle. I used to go for physiotherapy and swimming with them.
So you said it might come back. Does that mean you're cured at the moment? Could they cure it when you were little?
The honest answer to that is I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's within your body. And I think it's more to do with the fact that for someone like myself, I've always cheated when I've walked and danced and done anything. So I've overused one side of my body. And I think it's something to do with the nerve endings become exhausted, really. Mm-hmm. So what starts to happen then is that you start to... sometimes it's numbness, sometimes it's tingling. Some people go from being able to walk to being back on sticks and then eventually in wheelchairs. But it affects all people differently.
Have you seen a change in yourself of late recently?
I have had the tingling in my right thigh. I've had it for quite some time, actually. I don't know whether that's attributable to post-polio syndrome. At the moment, I don't think I want to know. I've had enough to deal with the CML. So I think at least I know it may come. And when it does come, then I'll have an idea of how to attack it. But they can't cure it. It's just something that they do recommend that you do regular exercise, nothing too energetic. I wouldn't be able to go for I wouldn't be able to run a marathon or even run at all.
But can you power walk?
I can walk on my treadmill, yeah.
Brilliant.
And I do.
Yeah.
And I do Pilates, which is so absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. Fantastic. Now, so you went on to be a dancer, which your family and everyone, it must have amazed them.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Well, my dad was really disappointed, actually, because he really wanted me to go to university. I think he thought I was quite a bright child.
Well, that's fantastic that he thought like that then. I mean, not many people even had university in their sights.
No. And credit to him. He really did want me to go to university. And... I didn't want to. I wanted to be a dancer. I was determined. I always remember the careers teacher at school, when you had these lessons and what are you going to be and what are you interested in? And they said, what are you going to be, Julia? And I said, well, I'm going to be a dancer. And he sort of looked at me and he went, yes, but what are you going to do to earn a living? And it kind of was the spur. It was sort of, well, I'm going to be a dancer. And I was fortunate that I was able to, get jobs where... they didn't necessarily require me to wear stilettos or very slim heels because that I can't do. I've never been able to do. Mm-hmm. I can't balance on a narrow heel.
But I think about dancing shoes. I think of kind of Anello and David. They're kind of like about 2-3 inches high, aren't they? They're very comfortable as well.
I kind of got away with it.
So you did that and you did things like summer seasons, pantomimes, all the things that you can imagine. And then you ended up getting... a record contract. I was so envious of that. Sounds brilliant in the 80s. What sort of band was it?
Well, by this time I'd met my other half. We've now been together 37 years. And he was a drummer. And he was doing a residency with a very, very good bass player. And we decided that we were going to form a band called Jewels on the Falls. The two of them wrote, it was predominantly my other half, Chris, that wrote the songs, but Paul would add, and I would do lyrics. And then we did some demos and went off and got ourselves a recording contract. And we thought, crikey, we're going to be the next big thing. And actually, we were pretty close in some respects, because the company we were with had a massive hit with I can't remember the artist, but the track was called Saddle Up. And we thought, crikey.
Is that Saddle Up and Ride Your Pony?
Yeah. So it was the same label. It was a different division of the same label. And we thought, so they're an up-and-coming label. And we really thought we'd cracked it. And then at the same time, Eddie Grant, who was also with another division of this same label, also had a massive hit. And it was a case
of... I don't want to dance.
You know them all, Jo. So basically there wasn't time to develop new talent, which was what we were. We were just at the start.
And did you have great fun doing gigs and things?
We didn't. We were a studio band.
Oh.
Yeah, we didn't go out. They could have done the gigs. I mean, I I can sing a bit, yeah. Not as good as you actually. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think it wasn't destined to be. And shortly after that, I got The Price Is Right. And so
what did you do on the? Were you like a glamour puss on The Price Is Right? Because I mean, come on, these are the days when women weren't allowed to do much talking.
No. Actually, do you know, it was really funny because when we auditioned for it, they did say they didn't want the sort of statuesque model types.
Anthea Turner.
Redfern, wasn't it? Yeah. That's what they didn't want. Mm. They wanted actresses. And I was sort of loosely considered an actress because I'd done a few bit parts and commercials and things like that. So I'd gone for the audition and... I got the audition and three other girls, so there was four of us. But it was really weird because they had us dressed in outfits that made us look like air hostesses. We had suits and...
So quite formal.
Yeah, it was.
Mm. What were you doing on the TV?
Well, it was standing by products and bringing guests, to play the different Price Is Right games. I had a fabulous time. I mean, I really enjoyed doing it. It was my first sort of... proper outing into television where I was doing a series rather than going and doing
one episode.
So it was really good fun, except at the time it was filmed in Nottingham, which of course is my hometown, but the camera people, the ACTT, I think were having a strike at the time, and so we would turn up at the studio and we'd go into makeup and we'd have our faces done and our hair done and everything, and then they'd say, sorry, we're not filming today.
It was really frustrating.
Yeah, and it did go on quite a while, several weeks. And at one point, they were talking about cancelling the show. It was supposed to be a 26-week run, I think. And we ended up doing 13 weeks. But it was just brilliant. I loved it.
So did that help you get your job at QVC?
No, not really.
How did you hear about QVC? Well, because remember, no one had heard of it.
No. I mean. The whole presenting thing didn't really come about till after I'd had my children. Mm. I'd had my daughter 13 months after I'd had my son, so they were really close together.
How old were you when you had them?
I was 30 when I had Daniel, and my daughter Sophie when I was 31, 13 months, yeah. Mm. So I'd been doing a couple of bits and bobs, things like Beatles About, and while I was pregnant, actually. And then after I got the two of them, you know, very, very young children, I thought, oh, gosh, I'm going to have a bit of a break. Mm. So I was doing odd things.
Yeah.
And fortunately, because Chris worked in the evenings as a musician, I would do things during the day. I started teaching fitness classes.
'80s.
I know. I was so 80s.
Leg warmers, headbands.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But that's, again, it's physical. It's really interesting. Yeah. You can't stop being physical.
I know. I'm mad, aren't I? Yeah. I know what you're thinking.
I think it's great because you're actually, you know, your body isn't, as you say, you have to work on it, but you haven't given up on your body.
No, yeah. And I won't. No, until it gives up on me, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had done... my first presenting job was at the Motor Show live, which was so nerve-wracking because it was like a on-the-hour presentation. And I had to remember everything. And I just, you know...
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
And while I was doing that, they were laying cables in my road. And my other half said, oh, he said... my other half's a presenter. Can she come and audition for you? And it was,
talking to a man in the road.
Yeah.
I love it.
So he gave him a number. My other half organised the audition. I wasn't even there. 3 days later, I went and did this audition. I was absolutely terrified. And they took me on. And then as a result of that, I was able to get a presenting agent who put me up for the QVC job.
Amazing. Mm. Thank God the man with the cable and your husband being so assertive.
Absolutely, yeah.
So he got you the gig. I mean, yeah.
He did. He's very supportive. He's fantastic, actually. I'm very lucky.
You really are. So that's absolutely brilliant. So QVC, I mean, is it extraordinarily successful now? I mean, I'm in this incredibly big building. I mean, it is shocking. I know you used to be just off the King's Road. That's when I first kind of noticed it. I mean, as in physically. And now you're here. You've been here a few years. I mean, is this just because it's so successful?
Well, we never owned Marco Polo House. And I think we wanted to be in charge of our own destiny. So it was decided the company was growing. And we were being very successful, even in a difficult economic time.
Because it's bargains.
Well, it isn't even just that. I think it's just people can trust us, so they know they're getting quality, and they the reassurance, you know, you watch it, you've got this money back guarantee, so if you're not happy, you actually can send it back, and it's not, you don't feel so bad. I feel really awkward taking things back in a shop because you can see my face and it's like, well, it didn't fit, or but you just put it back in the parcel and send it back. So yes, it had gone from strength to strength. I can remember in the early days we would be watched by about, you know, between 10 and 30,000 people across the entire country. And now I think the customer base is something like 27 million with over a million active customers at any given moment, which is fantastic. So yes, they decided to buy the building so we wouldn't have to pay rent. So in the end, it's cost effective.
Now, it also, I'll just talk a little bit more about QVC. It's the third biggest jewellery seller in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
That is incredible.
Well, I think what put us on the map was Diamondique, because obviously Diamondique, for anyone who doesn't know, is a simulated diamond. And it does mean you can get real diamond looks at a fraction of the cost. And it's always set in precious metal. So unlike High Street, where they tend to do it in plated metal, we do it in silver, or we'll do it in vermeil, which is still plated, but with a certain micron thickness of gold on the top. So it looks very real. We've got great manufacturers.
A lot of them are women, aren't they, these businesses?
Actually, I suppose, mention it. I've never really thought about it, but you're right.
Beauty, jewellery.
For example, on air today, we've got a brand called Laura Geller.
I know Laura.
Yeah, but that's a brilliant brand, you know, and probably would never have shown its face in the UK had it not been for us. So it does open up lots of avenues, you know, for British women to be able to buy things that otherwise they wouldn't be able to get.
Well, you know what I really like it for? I feel like I'm with my girlfriends when I watch it.
Well, that's great, because that's how it's meant to be. But I think we've always, when we first set it up, we always said, the original presenters always said, we wanted it to be the kind of over the garden fence approach rather than hard sell. It's not infomercial, it's more fun. It feels like you're with your girlfriends, you're watching something entertaining, but it just happens to be that you can also buy what you're looking at. So,
because I love the way, when I watch the beauty particularly, I'm always picking up beauty tips and makeup tips, you know, I mean, because that's obviously important to me. Now, let's go to your terrible, I mean, you just come from hospital, and I'm wondering whether that's to do with you were diagnosed with leukaemia.
Yes, in fact, I've just had my latest blood tests at the hospital today.
So when did that happen? And good God, how the hell have you coped?
3 years ago, I'd gone for a company health check, and everything was fine, except one blood test. So I'd sort of left, and they said, oh, it's all right, we'll be in touch in a couple of days, we just need to get it double checked. And I never suspected a thing. And I was at QVC, that was on the Tuesday, I think, and on the Thursday I was at QVC, and my mobile phone rang, and I was just preparing to go on air. And it was the doctor from the health check, and he said, oh, okay, can you talk? And you always get a kind of, you know, your heart misses a beat. And I said, yes, you know, far away. And he said, okay, so we've had the result of your blood test, and we are a little bit concerned. We need you to see a consultant hematologist as soon as you can. And when you hear something like that, it really is quite frightening. And I just said, okay, so, right, what do I do? And what do you think it is? And he said, well, we don't know, and I don't want to frighten you. He said, but we think it could be a form of leukemia. So I'm there sort of, you know, just about to go on air, and my other half was working. So I didn't have anyone I could ring and share it with. So I did my shift, went home. My son was living with us at the time, and I was perfectly normal with him, and he went off to bed. I didn't say anything. And then Chris got in about 1 a.m, and I just said to him, okay, so, you know, I've had this news, and I've got to go and see a haematologist. And he said, well, you know, what do they think it is? And I said, well, they think it might be leukemia. Anyway, to cut a long story sideways, on the Monday, I'd managed to get an appointment. So I went in and met my professor for the first time, and he just said to me, okay, well, we've got the results back, and it is chronic myeloid leukemia. And I said, is there any possibility that it you know, there's a mistake. He said, no. I said, okay, so what do we do?
Yeah, what the hell do we do now?
And I didn't, you know, I wasn't upset. I just kind of, I think I'd already accepted it. I think I already knew what it was going to be. And so I just needed to know how we faced it.
Now, did you have any symptoms at all?
Extreme tiredness. And I don't just mean, oh gosh, I'm working too hard, I need to pull back. I was debilitatingly tired. So I left the hospital that day with my oral chemotherapy drugs, my drugs to help the kidneys because they have to flush out loads of toxins and things, and a list of phone numbers, sort of, if you're ill over the weekend, ring immediately. And
Radio Gorgeous.
And just the instruction that I was not to have grapefruit or green tea. But apart from that, you know, carry on as normal.
Amazing.
And then about 10 days later, I think when all the drugs had started to really kick in, it's the only time during the whole last three years that I've had time off as a result of CML. I had 4 days off work because I just said to my boss, if I feel 60%, I'll come into work. If I drop below that, I can't.
So why haven't you been, like my mum's had cancer, why haven't you been hooked up to a machine and given tons of drugs? Why is it just this all, you know...
Well, I'm very lucky. Mm. A close friend of mine, actually, he's a former Crystal Palace footballer. He had the same leukemia as me. Mm. But he had it 15 years ago. And he had to have a bone marrow transplant. They now call it stem cell, I think. So you have to be hooked up to a donor, which is usually a family member. It's very dangerous. He went through all that and he's now walking around and cycling the Tour de France this year. Oh. to raise money for At Cure Leukemia, which is fantastic. He's brilliant. Jeff Thomas, his name is. But fortunately for me, because of the money that's been raised through charities like LLR and Cure Leukemia, they've now done research and they've come up with these drugs which are called inhibitors. And basically, it fools your body into not doing wrong what it was doing wrong. Because in my instance, it's the bottom of one chromosome, number 22, breaking off, and the bottom of number 9, and then they transmute. So you get dodgy chromosomes, basically, is what happens. And that's what you start to produce lots and lots of white blood cells, but they're not... fully grown, so they're immature, so all they're doing is crowding your blood from good stuff. Even over the last 3 years, it's moved on so much that my professor about a year ago was starting to say to me, well, they're now saying that they're starting to see one or two people who have reached complete molecular response, which is what you need to get to be classified as total remission. And 3 weeks ago, I found out that that's where I am.
Hooray! Oh, my God!
Yeah, so...
Oh, my God! That must have been... Oh, sorry. It must have been the most incredible day of your life.
I actually felt more emotional and more tearful being told that than when I was diagnosed.
Well, it's because you were... Imagine you've been holding it all this time. Yeah. You know, it's literally... Yeah. God, I mean, even then I could feel the massive whoosh, you know...
Yeah, that's amazing.
Fantastic. I'm so happy.
Thank you. I saw my professor today, first time since I had my results. Oh, and I must confess.
Did you give him a hug?
I did. fantastic
Quite
man.
Quite stiff and posh. Yeah.
Although he is a football fan and we often talk about football when I go.
So you're into footy as well?
I do love my football.
Who do you support?
I'm a massive Crystal Palace fan, although I have to now watch out for Swansea results because my son's now working for... Swansea City.
God, you really
Academy.
Are footballers.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So you can find Julia's book on Amazon, Life's a Beach, and the most wonderful thing about it is that each book sold, a donation will go to leukemia and lymphoma research.
That's right, yeah. It was important to me. I gave them a talk about 2 years ago about my experiences, and I just come up with the idea for the book then. And I did 100 lengths of the pool and gave some of the money to, as I mentioned earlier, BPF and Empolio Now. And I did promise them, I said, if I finish it and it gets into print and I make any profit, I said, I promise that some will come your way. So I'm just keeping my promise.
Julia Roberts, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Calling you, my dear, out of reach.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production 2015, produced and presented by Josephine Pembroke, edited by Anna Palinkas.